What happens when we die? How are some people able to see or communicate with spiritual worlds beyond our own? Can they offer answers to some of our most burning questions about life and death? Sarah Bullen, who has had a life-altering near-death experience herself, explores these mysteries as she gathers riveting stories of people from South Africa and beyond, people who have crossed to the other side, or those who can contact it. This book, titled The Other Side, offers original interviews with a fascinating collection of teachers with special abilities, individuals who've gone through near-death experiences, or those who can communicate across worlds using mediumships, gifts, trance, and plants. In this episode of PageCast, Sarah Bullen is interviewed by editor, writer, and storyteller Penina Fenster. Enjoy.
Hello and hello. I'm Penina Fenster, writer, editor, and creative consultant, and I'm thrilled to be talking today with the vibrant and fascinating Sarah Bullen, a multi-published author, international writing coach, literary agent, and much more, as we'll soon discover. Sarah's best-selling books include Love and Above, A Journey into Shamanism, Coma, and Joy, and Write Your Book in 100 Days. She's the founder of The Writing Room and Kent Literary, where she mentors and represents literally hundreds of writers. And in between all that, she hosts renowned writing retreats around the world. Sarah's latest book, The Other Side, Journeys into Mysticism, Magic, and Near Death, is an enticing, soulful, and utterly engrossing exploration of questions that have captivated human beings for millennia. What happens when we die? What are the realms we experience when we work with trance, dance, plant medicines, and prayer? And what do ancient cultures and belief have to tell us that science is only beginning to discover? Sarah, how fabulous to be with you. And to begin at the beginning, what exactly do you mean when you talk about the other side?
Thank you, Penina. Lovely to join you. Well, that's a really good question. And I think the reason the book was titled this was it really was posing a question. It was really asking, what is out there? And in fact, a bigger question really, it's, is there anything out there? And if there is, how can I connect with it, know that it's there, touch it, communicate with it? So in a bigger sense, the other side is everything we cannot see, those unseen realms and worlds, which some people call after death, life after death. And because the book is dealing with a near-death experience and the conversations around what actually happens when you have a near-death experience, in a bigger sense, the other side is asking, what is beyond this visceral, visual life we live?
Well, then that's going to take me to, I think, a question that it's a long, long intrigue for your readers, which is that one of the most striking elements of the other side is that it literally and metaphorically begins with your own near-death experience. Can you tell us about something of that near-death experience? How did it come about? That where Hamlet talks about, you know, in the sleep of death, what dreams may come. What happened to you?
So how this current book, The Other Side, came about really has been a decade-long journey. And the journey really has been one into near-death experience. It started in the year 2012. I was 36 going on 37. I was married. I had a husband. He was a filmmaker, just hitting his 40s, 41 years old. We had two young children, and I'd had a rather difficult 4 years. Difficult because my husband had been diagnosed with brain cancer 4 years earlier, and we were really in the very last stages of his life, of his journey with brain cancer. It was the last month of his life, and I was fit and I was healthy and I was busy and I was running the show and I was making the money and I was running the house and I thought I was on top of the world, but I got a tickle in my throat, a little bit of a chest cold. I snapped off an order to my office. I said, courier my laptop back home. I'm going to be back at work on Monday. I couldn't take a day's break. I couldn't take my foot off the pedal because I was in a big job. I was racing around. I was being efficient and effective. And what happened was I wasn't back at work on Monday at all. In fact, within 24 hours, my tickle in my throat had spread to my lungs into pneumonia, and I was rushed to hospital, and I was in ICU, and within a few hours later, I was on life support in an induced coma, and I was to stay in that coma for the next 3.5 weeks. So this was what was happening to my body, to the physicality of this 36-year-old. However, at the same time, something completely different was happening to my soul, my spirit, whatever name you want to use for it. So while my body was lying on the bed in Constantiaberg Hospital in the ICU room, my soul was going on a very extended journey, a journey which is later I discovered a near-death experience. What makes the situation even more crazy was my husband was entering the final month of his life, and he too slipped into a coma. So he was in a hospital down the road from me. He was at Vincent Pilotti. I was in Constantiaberg. Both of us were in a comatose state. And what strangely happened during my very extended near-death experience is the two of us met in a spirit world, in a different realm, where we said our goodbyes to each other. So that story, that journey, was a month long. And, you know, at the time, Penina, and I think many of the listeners will understand, I didn't know it was a near-death experience. I knew that I was traversing the universe. I knew I was nowhere near the body. I, in fact, knew exactly what was happening, so much so that when I woke up eventually, when I was finally, let me call it, brought back to life after a very long battle for my life, I actually wrote everything down. I documented, I sent it ultimately to a near-death experience journal. And the detail I recorded it in is something that never faded. I still have those notes from that day, which formed very much so the beginning of Love and Above. And when I moved into the next book, The Other Side, again, the vivid memories of that experience were so super clear. And it was so long, Penina, and I think you know that the phases of the coma and the levels and the stages I went through in my soul travels, I've really documented in quite a rigorous way in both of the books, actually. So maybe I'll stop there, and we'll come back to that and where I traveled to and what I saw and heard and felt.
It is really, even having read it now, and being familiar with it, I actually find myself at a loss for words, because it's such a radical experience that you went through. And that raises a lot of questions about, I think, what you explore in The Other Side. A lot of it is what we can learn from these encounters with realms that aren't our everyday. So you explore your own NDE and other people's and all sorts of mystical experiences in The Other Side. So Sarah, I'm very curious, of all these stories, which touched you most profoundly and which surprised you the most?
Wow. Very interestingly, you know, there wasn't a story in that book that wasn't one that I had very, very carefully selected. I want to backtrack a little bit, because after my own coma story, I didn't really talk about it much. In fact, because my husband had died, a death was a lot bigger. I was to find in all the interviews I did over the decade that this was very common. Many of the near-death experiences didn't talk about it very much afterwards. And the reason being is that nobody announces that you died. Nobody says you had surgery, sorry, we lost you for 6 minutes, or you were declared dead on arrival at the hospital, which was one of the interviewees, Glenn Douglas Haig. So people didn't know that had a near-death experience. So what does happen, and this is the surprising thing, is everybody I interviewed pieced it together slowly. So that's the first thing to say, including myself. In fact, you will see in the book that it's only much later, when I went back to see my doctors, when I got my hospital records, when I correlated what had happened in these spirit realms to the Facebook threads and the medical records that I realized what had actually happened. What I knew in my heart was this incredibly strange spiritual journey. I realized in retrospect it had happened. So that was the strange thing in all of these stories, was that everybody that I interviewed over the decade had themselves to forensically piece together what happened. The strangest one for me is potentially Glenn Douglas Haig, the man I mentioned earlier. Glenn Douglas was in the prime of his life, in his 30s. He had moved into a brand new house in Chartwell in Johannesburg, and his house was stormed by armed robbers who just out of nowhere started firing, and he was shot 7 times. That's part of the story itself is gripping enough. But the paramedics arrived. They got Glenn in the ambulance. They drove towards the hospital. He heard them turning the wrong way. He knew that already that they'd gone the wrong way. He was out by Sunning Hill. And that's really the last thing of the body he remembers, because he was catapulted out of his body and into a spiritual realm where he went on a bit of a journey there. And maybe we'll talk later about the stages of near-death experiences. And he pretty much went through all of them. He went through a life review. He sat before a council of elders. He was given a choice. He was given a mission. And he came back and he woke up and he was in a gurney going into a mortuary at the hospital. And he breathed. And obviously at that point, they realized this body is alive. And they rushed him into surgery and eventually saved his life. Glenn equally only pieced together his story 12 months. No, it was more like 8 months later when he bumped into the paramedic at a local restaurant and said to him, "Thank you so much for saving my life." And the guy said, "But you were dead on arrival." So that story is really, I'm just going to call it one of the rock star stories. It's so staggering. It's so graphic. It's so well documented. It's so believable. It's so meticulously recorded by the man and the medical records that was something that surprised me a lot. And then, there's just so many surprising ones. I think one, Penina, that touched me the most, because that was the first question, was part of a category that isn't a near-death experience. It was called an out-of-body experience. And I included this in the book because the actual verified near-death experiences in Southern Africa I could find were not as many as I thought. And this was Anthony Kairos. Now, Anthony Kairos was 21 years old when he was a rugby player about to leave for America to become a professional. And he went to the Magaliesberg on a scrambling day to say farewell. And in a seemingly tiny little slip of the foot, he fell off his bike and he broke his neck. And Anthony has been a quadriplegic for the last 25 years. He's now in his mid-40s. And Anthony's out-of-body experience didn't happen then. It happened weeks later, months later. This incredible frustration of this young man, unable to do anything but blink his eyes. And he lay on a bed and he screamed and he raged and he ranted and he screamed at God and he said, "I want to die. This is enough. I hate you," which he didn't say in those words. And in a flick of a finger, in a heartbeat, he was out of his body. And he was sitting at the foot of God. His version of God, and I always qualify by saying that, sat standing at the palm and the foot of God and shown his own lifeless body on the bed. This young man's body who could no longer walk, would never walk again. And he was given a choice of, do you want to go back and still be in this body? And he said, he was 21 years old. He said, hell yes. He wasn't ready to die, and that moment is so touching and it's so powerful, and it just shows the incredible power of the other side, how it can penetrate, how it can grab you, how it can be there in the times when you need something the most. So those are the two very long answers to a very quick question.
Well, they both are striking stories, and I also found Anthony's story incredibly moving, along with many other moving stories in the book. Now, he had a sense that he needed to come back to help other people. And that does seem to be something that recurs in accounts of NDEs and out-of-body experiences, the sense that, you know, we're here to help each other. So, and then, by contrast, Glenn Douglas, who also said, of course, we're here to love each other, he kind of semi-joked that he came back for the whiskey and the sex. And you said that you'd had a message to have more fun in life. So, Sarah, that raises this question for me. If things have purpose, which we like to believe, otherwise stuff is just too random and overwhelming and terrifying, then these experiences have purpose. So what have you seen from your interviewees in terms of what they have to teach us?
Yes, and that's it's a really interesting thing, because the first thing is a near-death experience is an unwanted event. Nobody is looking to nearly die or die. So it's not like we are searching. And I want to qualify that, because part three of the book, I interview and speak to people who are searching, people who are using plants and mediums and psychics and trance and medicines to try and connect to the other side. So there, they are people who are trying to connect. However, a near-death experience, an out-of-body experience, is brought on in an unwanted way. And here's a really strange and interesting thing. Many people don't ever do anything with it. So there are people who have these bizarre and weird things, and they just sort of go on with their lives and as if it never happened. In fact, there's a category of NDE experiences that are called denialists. They just went, oh, that didn't happen. So just because you have what is a really mystical, otherworldly experience doesn't actually mean you have to do anything about it. And I found people who didn't. They really went, oh, I don't know what that means. I'm going to leave that behind me, put that in a box and throw it away. Even if those experiences were quite unpleasant and traumatic, and there are many examples in the book where they were. So the other flip side of the coin is that many people in a near-death experience, when they've traversed and left the body and gone through some of the phases, which is sometimes it's ascension, which is going upwards towards the light, and in other times it's descension, so going down through a tunnel or into the center of the earth, or however they experience this journey. So that's the first phase. And then the second phase is a feeling of a divine presence. So that's the next stage. And then the third, one of the third tick boxes is a review of your life. Now, this is the interesting place, because this is the place that many people have come back and changed, this life review. It's one of the things that qualifies you as having had a near-death experience. And in very many cultures, they call it different things. So the one is a review of your life. The one calls it the book of life. Some people call it the Akashic records. Some call it the sum of all knowledge. But there seems to be, or the council of elders, there seems to be a moment in which many people who are facing the barrier between life and death are asked to look at their life and review what they have done with it and take a look at whether they've really used their gifts or talents. And it's in this place that often the choice is made to come back or not come back, or the choice is not even made. It's simply given. So in Glenn Douglas's, his was just this huge experience of incredible love, that love is at the heart of everything. In a number of the near-death experiences, that has been a very similar message. In some of the indigenous near-death experiences, which are also documented in this book, that message that they came back with, that knowledge that they came back with, could be something quite simple, Panina, and it could be something like, use this plant to heal the woman in your village, or you need to be a healer, which is quite common in the realm of the Sangoma journey, which there's a number of Sangomas interviewed in this book where they cross that barrier between life and death, and they were told that they have a calling. So the messages came, and you did mention the message that I was given, and I was also given that in a very strange way. It was that, and it was given to me directly, that message, by what I call my spirit guide. I call him the forest man in the book. It was an otherworldly figure who really helped me get back in my body. Having been in a coma for almost 3 weeks, it was very hard. It was hard to get, it's very hard to come out of a coma. It was a huge battle. And in that spirit being who helped me back, at the very end of my battle, when I was sort of waking up and going back into unconsciousness, I asked him telepathically, because I had a huge, you know, life support machine strapped to my face and I couldn't speak. I said, "What must I do? You know, what must I do?" And he bent down and he kissed me on my forehead and he said, "Have more fun." And again, you know, in the months that followed.
Yeah.
And in the years that followed, that message was so weird for me. I thought, my goodness, people have these profound messages and I'm told to have more fun. So it took me a very long time.
I think that the best message.
Yeah,
I didn't feel like it. And then it took years to live into the deeper meaning behind that. That message of being, that this joy we can have in these bodies, right?
I love that message because you the alternative, you might have had a message like shave your head and, you know, only eat lettuce and, you know, sleep on the floor and live a really tough life. And instead of an abstemious message, you got to have more fun. I find that extremely reassuring. Do you have more fun?
Absolutely do. I do. Not for a year, because, you know, I was traumatized. I was very traumatized. I'd nearly lost my life. I had to fight for my life after waking up. I had to learn to breathe again. I had to learn to sit again. I had to learn to think again, to walk again. My husband had died. It was a terribly tortuous, horrendous time. My children were traumatized, age 7 and 9. And yet this little knock, this woodpecker on my shoulder was saying to me, "But what was that about? Why am I being told to have fun?" And it really bothered me. And, you know, I ended up putting it above my desk. I always put visual cues, and that those three words, "have more fun," that they played in my brain. I couldn't let them go. And it changed my life. I actually made some vows I write about in Love and Above, when I really realized what they meant. You know, and the first vow was to say yes to adventure, to say yes to things. Yes, okay, because yes is that opening of the heart. And then I did crazy stuff. I pulled both of my children out of school, lock, stock, and barrel. I uprooted my entire family, and we moved to a tiny Greek island where we lived for 4 years, just playing. So I did crazy things, and I really took it on. I really took on that directive, that message, that little secret, I think I like to call it, from beyond and above.
And I think you share that incredible appetite for adventure and courage, because I do want to say you're hugely courageous. You know, this is all very well in a book, but some of it must have been ghastly to go through. But you do these literary retreats around the world. You write books in which you encourage people, inspire people. So it's a very profound take on having more fun. But I want to segue into something that relates to the whole of the other side and into your mentioning Sangomas. So there are some areas of these experiences that are common across the globe, whatever the religion, but there are very few collected accounts of the African experience. And you've got a distinctly African perspective. So how do you think all of those personal, cultural beliefs, religion, spiritual values fit into the picture? What's the difference that makes something a distinctly African perspective on this?
Yeah, and you know, I very deliberately went about to acquire those stories. I think the first reason it was really interesting to me was that my personal experience of near death had a very shamanic component to it. I didn't have the experiences that are very well documented in the Western world. I didn't go through a tunnel and up towards the light. I didn't see God. There were not archangels and angels and beautiful music. Well, there was beautiful music. In fact, in my experience, I was taken by a tribe of African women. I was sung to, and I was sung songs of death and of farewell. And I was told to let go of my husband, that he was being taken by the men and he was going away. And I was comforted by them. That was in one of the levels of coma or of near death. From that, I moved further and further away. So I left that very African lens of it. And I moved further and further away into ultimately what I call the great universe, the nothingness, creation, great mystery, whatever people name it. I was out there in the far reaches of the universe as a little light, a soul light, surrounded by other soul lights. You know, and when I came back and when I wrote Love and Above, and I started talking about my near-death experience, I spoke on stages internationally and at near-death experience conferences, and everybody else had a very similar story. And I had this really weird African story. And I started to ask a lot of questions. You know, is this a lens of our culture? Are other people in Southern Africa having similar experiences to me? And because I'm a journalist and because I've done investigative journalism and for many years, I kind of put my journalistic hat on and I started to interview people and gather stories. And they're in the book. And there is a very Southern African lens from the indigenous experience, of which I couldn't find many people living who I could verify. So I went to records, to the Sangoma. So one of the great interviewees was Godfrey Madlatle. He runs a very large traditional healing clinic in Soweto. He was one of the founding members of the Council of Traditional Healers. And he himself is a near-death experiencer. And we spoke very widely about his own perspective and his own experience with near-death. And many people who come from the lens of a traditional African culture have found that calling speaks to them about going back into the healing arts. Now, in Southern Africa, Sangomas, Nyangas, people of the ancestors are often called to work as healers, as traditional doctors. And he was no different. But what's really interesting is he grew up as a Christian. In fact, anything, you know, African in the sense of pre-colonized Africa was regarded as very bad in his lens. So again, the question came up, is what happens in these mystical experiences? Is it our culture? Is it our belief system? Are there more in Africa that we can gather and use? You're also going to find in the book that there's a Kabbalic a rabbi. There's a woman, Taz Singh, who grew up in what she calls a staunch Hindu family. The truth of the matter, and this is really my perspective, is what people experience, it doesn't differ from culture to religion to country. The tiny nuance can differ, but the experience in this strange thing called near death is quite universal. It steps out of all labels. It goes beyond all labels. It goes beyond the realms of ancestors, of names we put, of Jesus's, of you know, Buddhas, of Marys, of any name we put on what is divinity. And it seems to go a few levels above to the bigger thing out there, which whatever that may be. I start the book with a sentence. It's really funny I'm saying this, by Taz Singh, that says there is something really big out there beyond all that we know and all that we see. And that really came through.
Yeah, in fact, that's the profound and very beautiful message that ultimately I took out of the book. And especially at this time for humankind, I mean, we're all going, where's meaning, where's purpose, what's going on? And I found your book incredibly reinforcing in terms of what you're saying, that there's something that we do all share. And there's something comforting about that other side. Final question. is, can you please share your info so that listeners can discover more about you, find out about future book talks and events? I know that you do a lot to do with The Other Side that you'll be involved in.
Absolutely. So they can look me up at thewritingroom.co.za or ZA, as we say in South Africa. Or they can find me on Facebook or Instagram. Don't ask me what those are, but I will probably pop them in the link. And yes, and if anybody does have stories that are similar as well, to send them in, because there's been a big call and a big interest in gathering more stories of Southern Africa. It's a very unrecorded part of this very big body of study of near death, which has been really going on for 20, 30 years, rigorously studied by science, and yet quite under-recorded in the South, Southern Africa particularly. So I'd love people to get hold of me and send me those as well. So it's Sarah Bullen and it's thewritingroom.co.za.
Yeah, but speaking personally, I would also love them to get hold of you, because I'm waiting for the next book along these lines. So I want to conclude with a reminder to please look out for The Other Side, Journeys into Mysticism, Magic and Near Death. Totally intriguing, and I found unputdownable. And also, I want to say that the cover and the design by Sean Robertson are really terrific. It is a beautifully designed book. It's a lovely object apart from anything else. So I would describe the design of this book as striking, vivid, expressive, intriguing, much like the author herself.
Thank you, Penina. And I love that you spoke of the design, because I don't know if people know that the book cover is so rigorously detailed in terms of really trying to pull in the feelings within. So the number of covers we went through and the kind of nuance, and this goes for all book covers, that they really hold the feeling, the energy of that book so beautifully. So thank you for that beautiful design as well.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you, Jonathan Bull.